The Interchange is brought to you by Wonder Capital, the leading solar investment platform. Wonder gets your commercial solar projects done fast, and if you're an investor, Wonder gets your money to projects efficiently and helps you earn up to 7.5% annually. If you want your project financed or want to invest, you can sign up at wondercapital.com/GTM. That's Wonder with a U, wondercapital.com/GTM. We're also brought to you by Shoals Technologies Group, the industry's top equipment maker for solar and storage. Your project deserves the best balance of systems tech so you can drive down costs and boost performance. And there's only one place to turn, Shoals. Find out more at shoals.com. That's S-H-O-A-L-S, shoals.com. This is The Interchange, conversations on the future of energy from Green Tech Media. I'm Stephen Lacey. Welcome. This week, a few rounds of energy-themed Would You Rather. We'll tackle some sticky energy scenarios posed by you, our listeners. And with me to take up the challenge is my co-host, Shale Khan. He's the Senior VP of Research and Strategy at the venture capital firm Energy Impact Partners. Hey, Shale.
Hey, Stephen.
So earlier this summer, we held our deep decarbonization draft here on The Interchange, and we got such an overwhelming response, partly, I think, because it was a new way of tackling an oft-debated subject. You know, how do you get to really deep decarbonization? And we've gone over and over that, but we gamified it, and people responded to that. So we're periodically trying to cover common issues in a new way and interact with our listeners more, which brings us to today's Would You Rather theme. We recently put out the call on Energy Twitter for some either-or scenarios, and we were not disappointed. We got dozens of thought-provoking responses. So over the weekend, Shale and I sorted through them and chose our top three, and that's what we're talking about this week. So Shale, what made you choose the ones you did? Like, what was most compelling about them?
I mean, I was really super impressed overall with the quality of the Would You Rathers that Energy Twitter delivered to us. I was busy before we sent out the call starting to come up with some of my own, and I just discarded all of them because the ones that came from the collective hive mind of the internet were so much better. So they were all really good, and I had a hard time choosing. But I guess the thing that distinguished the three that I ultimately picked as my favorites were two things. One, they're all positive Would You Rathers. Like, they're all envisioning, in either case, a world that I want. And two, I think more importantly, they're very hard for me to decide. Every one of these, like, I'm going into this conversation, I don't know my answers to any of these three right now because I can't quite make up my mind. So that's, to me, the mark of a good Would You Rather, is like, it's actually a really difficult question to answer.
Wait, you don't know your answers yet?
No. I like started taking notes to myself on each one. So I have some ideas of, like, basically I know what my thinking is and I just don't know where I'm going to land. This is actually a strategy that I employ sometimes at restaurants when I can't decide what to order, which is I use pressure to make the decision for me. And so I have like three things in my mind on the menu. And then when the waiter comes over, I just, whatever I say is what I order. So I intend to do that here.
I was so impressed with the quality of the scenarios and the quality of the people who were proposing those scenarios. But I got to say, Energy Twitter's pretty clean. You know, most of the Would You Rather games I've played are fairly dirty. So I was impressed with the professionalism as well.
There were a few in there. There was like, I can't remember exactly what it was, but one of them was like, I don't know, something about watching the world burn. Like, there were some like depressing climate change ones in there.
Okay, well, let's turn to them. So we'll go back and forth. We've got three apiece. We'll do six. And we will identify the person who proposed it, go through the scenario, and then debate our answers. So you have the floor, sir.
Okay. The first one is a take on an old conversation we've had many times, but with a bit of a twist. This one comes from Brian Bursick, who's the CEO of Wonder Capital, incidentally an upcoming guest on the What It Takes podcast, so you'll hear from him directly. But he had a good one. So the question is, would you rather have $10 billion spent in renewable deployment funding, that's option one, startup funding, presumably in clean tech, that's option two, or R&D, that's option three?
The week that he tweeted this out, there was some big flare-up in Energy Twitter about R&D versus deployment, and I rolled my eyes, but I thought that this one was appropriate because that debate still is a raging.
Yeah, right? Like, there's the forever debate about deployment versus R&D. So I think the addition of startup funding makes it a little bit different to think about those three. But still, yeah, this is a way to ask that very old school question of what do we need more money for deployment or R&D? So what do you think?
Well, the addition of the startup funding option was a really good one, and that made it more nuanced. And so I had to go with the startup funding. There are so many interesting companies out there with tech coming out of labs that need to get over the valley of death. And I think we're in this, you know, state of climate emergency. So I want to support groundbreaking early technologies that can make a huge impact medium term, but that are ready to come out of the lab or already out of the lab and can scale with relative speed. So somewhere in the middle, you know, like there's plenty of capital being deployed to the existing solutions today. And there are lots of startups with great ideas with tech that is almost ready for market. And I would want to satisfy that piece of the market.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sort of biased towards startup funding because that's the world that I live in now anyway. But I was trying to think about where would my $10 billion go the furthest. And so $10 billion deployed into projects actually isn't that much in the grand scheme of how much money is getting deployed into renewable projects every right. single year at this point. $10 billion in R&D goes a very long way. You know, that's equivalent to the annual budget for clean tech R&D for most big countries combined. So that would get you a long distance. But startup funding, I think, yeah, like you said, it sort of sits in this like pleasant middle spot where it serves as de facto R&D for some of the companies that are more tech heavy. But it also, you know, a lot of startups, especially the ones that are trying to deploy projects, will use some of their venture capital money to go into projects, especially in the early days. Like this is how SolarCity and Sunrun got started. They raised venture capital and put some of that money into projects, which was effectively deployment funding. It's not an efficient way to do that in the long term. The capital is too expensive, but it can actually get you some projects, some early pilots and things like that. So I think we're in agreement on this one, startup funding.
Yep, absolutely. Okay, so we're in agreement on that one. Let's go over to Eric Hittinger, a professor at the Rochester Institute of Technology and a longtime energy Twitter expert. He asked, would you rather see oil suddenly go to $20 a barrel or $200 a barrel? This is a tricky one. What do you think?
I guess I'm confused why this one is a hard question. What is the argument for $20 a barrel?
Well, there are two arguments. One is the consumer-centric argument. So if climate change is not your top priority, low oil prices are good for consumers. And there's a ton of people who will always believe that low oil prices are better for the economy largely. Second is that low oil prices make it more difficult to go into deep offshore drilling for certain fracking operations to be viable. And I think largely the fracking industry has been resilient in the face of low oil and gas prices. With that said, you definitely limit a lot of drilling operations with low oil prices. So maybe there's an economic and environmental case to be made.
Yeah, I guess. I thought what you were going to argue is that low oil prices are going to cause a bunch of oil and gas companies to collapse. There's a good piece in the Wall Street Journal a little while back about the next bubble, which is all the fracking companies that have been losing money for so long and how long they can sustain that, how long they can keep funding operations. I thought that was the argument you were going to make. I don't know. Neither of those really move me a whole lot. To me, the thing that is going to best incentivize the search for alternatives to oil is going to be high oil prices that stay high, and that'll, you know, incentivize the switch to electric and the search for alternative fuels and all of that. So to me, this one's an easy one for me. I pick $200.
Yeah. So if oil goes to $20 a barrel, transportation, electrification, and other alternatives are just way harder. If oil goes to $200 a barrel, it changes the game for transportation, but it does put a pretty serious hurt on consumers. And I think that's why it feels tricky to me, because cheering for $200 a barrel is necessarily cheering for a lot of people to be hit hard. And it's, I think that you have to consider the consumer impact as well. $200 a barrel is very high.
Yeah. Well, just to be clear, I'm not cheering for either of these, right? The whole point of a would you rather is you got to choose between the two. So if I'm choosing between the two, for me, it's an easy decision to pick 200, but I don't do that lightly. I hear everything you're saying.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely have to go with $200 a barrel as well. It's the only way you can push enough consumer demand for EVs and public transit options fast enough. And yeah, it would hurt in the short term, but We have lots of options that we didn't have in 2008 when oil prices were extremely high. So I think we've evolved a lot technologically in transportation and in home heating so that fewer consumers would be hurt.
Okay, well, I guess we've agreed on two for two so far, so hopefully we can find some areas of disagreement. My next one...
Yeah, we agree too much.
all right, we could solve that. My next one is from Elizabeth, and forgive me for mispronouncing her last name, Elizabeth Buechler, who's a PhD student at Stanford. Her question was, would you rather have perfect load forecasting capabilities or perfect wind and solar forecasting algorithms?
I'm so curious what your answer is. I have to go with perfect load forecasting. I mean, it just gives you way better demand side management capabilities. And the fewer electrons you can produce to meet demand, the better. And, you know, I think battery storage will largely deal with the wind and solar variability problem. And we already have really good weather forecasting. So that's not the issue. So being able to fine tune load forecasting will be a boon to distributed resources and virtual power plants, and really good for the customer too, because you can predict better how to use those distributed resources. So I definitely have to go with perfect load forecasting.
So I found this one to be tough. There's this quote that we've been using a bunch internally at EIP because I just think it really does a good job of describing the future state of the grid, which is we overheard it from somebody who we won't name because we don't know if it was for the public consumption at a MISO symposium. And the quote is, in the past, we used to forecast load and dispatch generation. And in the future, it will be the reverse. So if you think of the future universe where generation is mostly mostly intermittent and load is malleable because there's a bunch of demand flexibility, then I think it's possible you might need perfect wind and solar forecasting even more than you need good load forecasting, because load forecasting is an exercise that only has... it has less value in a world where so much of the load is flexible. You don't need to forecast load. You need to figure out how to shift it around. And what you really need is to figure out how much it needs to be shifted. And you need to figure out how much you're going to need to store and all that kind of stuff, which is a function of exactly how much generation is there going to be from these intermittent resources in real time. And you know, if it's perfect wind and solar forecasting algorithms, then you can predict seasonal differentials and, you know, there can be year to year different significant differences in how much wind generation there is from the same location. So I go with wind and solar forecasting algorithms here, though I'm having a hard time committing to it.
Yeah, I just think that the tools in wind and solar forecasting are already so good. Like,
they're definitely
that much better, right?
They definitely improved a lot, but I don't think we have perfect forecasting capabilities in either case. It's a bigger issue in wind than it is in solar, but predicting both in very short term, you know, real time, and also again to the seasonal and annual differences, we can guess at it, but there's still a fair amount of variability.
I think that the load forecasting capabilities, as they get more sophisticated, open up all these opportunities for virtual power plants to meet local needs. And if you can really dial that in, then you can fine tune how these virtual power plants operate. So to me, that feels like a bigger opportunity.
Maybe. Yeah. I'm wondering how much you need perfect load forecasting in order to dispatch those resources. But look, I mean, this is a hard one for me. I see what you're saying.
Hey, we finally disagree on something. Coming up, an electric truck or electric car, HVDC lines or next generation nukes. Plenty more thought-provoking scenarios on the way. First, though, a quick word about our interchange sponsors. Wonder Capital can help you, the commercial solar developer, secure financing for your project, and they can help you, the investor, put money into those projects and earn up to 7.5% annually. Through its innovative underwriting platform, Wonder is financing 100 kilowatt to 5 megawatt solar PV projects, including those for nonprofits, community solar developments, virtual net metering, and PV and storage systems. Find out how Wonder Capital can help you finance your next commercial solar project by heading over to wondercapital.com/financing. We're also supported by Shoals Technologies Group. Shoals has been serving the PV industry since the 90s with the best balance of systems equipment, and it now serves storage developers too. So when you're building your solar project, your storage project, or your solar plus storage project, you're under crazy pressure to keep those costs down. Don't skimp. Get the best equipment. Shoals is the only place to turn for the highest quality American-designed equipment. Find out more at shoals.com. That's S-H-O-A-L-S, shoals.com.
Okay, so what is your second favorite, would you rather?
This one comes from Michael Noble, who is the CEO of Fresh Energy and a good friend of GTM. He asks, would you rather have a national HVDC overlay grid or ready-to-go next-generation nuclear plants with excellent ramping capability? That's quite a mouthful, and that's like the holy grail of nuclear power plants. So this one was kind of hard for me as well. What did you think, Shale?
Yeah, I thought this was a good tough one. So I'm in an interesting state right now, both mentally and literally, in that I'm sitting in smoke-filled Northern California with wildfires raging all around me, and you know, have been thinking about, I've been a big proponent of the national HVDC overlay grid idea, build out a ton of transmission to support the growth of renewables. And I think I still generally support that, but I'm currently thinking about it in the context of wildfire risk that that causes. And so now I'm modulating my excitement a little bit just because I'm breathing in tons of particles at the moment.
Well, let me stop you there. I think it's important to contextualize what you just said. Please explain why there's speculation about that large campfire being started by utility equipment.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's exactly it, right? We don't have the full report yet on what caused the campfire, which is the one in Northern California that is the deadliest wildfire in American history and is still raging and still causing all sorts of problems and a huge humanitarian crisis. We don't know exactly what caused it, but there's some speculation that it actually came from a PG&E. I think either from a PG&E transmission line getting downed or potentially from a substation.
I think it was a transmission line.
Yeah. Either way, I mean, I saw somebody making the point that, look, the more of this stuff you build, the bigger the risk is going to be. And they were trying to use that as an argument for distributed energy, basically. I haven't done enough analysis to figure out whether on net that causes more risk or less risk, but it's a factor I wasn't really thinking about before when I was, you know, constantly out there evangelizing building HVDC lines. So anyway, that's in my mind. But the one thing that I think is missing from this question, again, the question is, would you rather have an HVDC overlay grid or ready-to-go next-generation nuclear plants with excellent ramping capability? On the nuclear side of that, the final part of that that isn't answered is, are they cost-effective? Like, are they competitive? Because I think I would love to see us having, you know, easily ramping next-generation nuclear plants that are cost competitive with other sources of flexibility today. If that said that, I think I would answer the nuclear plants, but because it doesn't, and I don't have a ton of faith in the ability of nuclear to cost down and to become competitive, I think I stick with the HVDC overlay grid. How about you?
I thought a lot about NIMBYism, actually. And because I ignored the cost issue, I thought about the troubles that you would have siting these facilities. And the most pressing challenges for both is NIMBYism, people's resistance. Building a huge network of transmission would create a lot of resistance in communities, and so would building a bunch of new nuclear plants. And so that faces both technologies and made the decision difficult for me. With that said, I think I have to go with nuclear plants. A quote, ready to go. And ready to go means like ready to deploy now. Next generation plant with ramping, excellent ramping capability. Like, if you care about decarbonization over anything, I think you have to go with ready to build nuke plants, right?
I don't know why you have to. No. I mean, I think that they'd be a net positive from a decarbonization perspective. They'd be great. But I don't know why they have to be so much better than transmission. I think if you're building out a massive HVDC grid, you know, you're doing it in order to transmit renewable electrons from places where they're generated to places where they're needed. I think you could pretty safely assume that. So anyway, I think they're both good from a decarbonization perspective.
I'm still torn on this one, but since you brought up the safety issue, you know, whether or not transmission lines can create bigger vulnerabilities, you have to apply that to nuclear plants as well. Both technologies face similar drawbacks in siting, in terms of maybe unforeseen safety issues, and in potential cost. So to me, when you look at all those factors, it's still a split decision.
That you're not allowed to come up with a split decision, my friend. You got to pick a side.
Okay, fine. I'm choosing nuclear.
Okay.
Nuclear.
You're in the nuclear bed. Now you must sleep in it.
I'm going to get so much shit on Twitter.
We're talking about, we've already covered like Energy Twitter's hottest topics. We've talked about R&D versus deployment. We've talked about nuclear and high voltage transmission lines. And we've talked about the price of oil. That's the trifecta.
Totally. All right. What's your next one?
All right. So my last one is another tough one for me. This one comes from Matt Stevens Rich, who's an EV specialist at the Electrification Coalition. And he asked, would you rather have an electric Ford 150 or a $15,000 EV? So the context here is for folks who haven't been paying a ton of attention to the EV world, like the biggest gap in the market, at least in my opinion, the biggest gap in the market right now for electric vehicles is exactly that Ford F-150, especially for fleets that are trying to electrify. This is true of a lot of utilities. Many utilities signed on to this EEI pledge to electrify 5% of their fleet every year. And, you know, if you have a fleet and you're a utility, a lot of those are those like Ford F-150 or Ford F-250 trucks, for which there isn't a great solution right now in terms of electrification. You can retrofit them sometimes. There's a couple of companies that will do that. And there are some new companies popping up that are going after this mid and sort of light heavy duty market for EVs, but they're definitely not Ford. And so you have to move from buying your Ford F-150 to buying a workhorse truck or change truck or something like that. If we had a Ford F-150 ready and available that was electric today, I think it would get adopted pretty fast. On the other hand, a $15,000 electric vehicle, period, you know, that's clearly a game changer. Now, my presumption is that that $15,000 electric vehicle isn't like a smart car. It's like a normal sedan, you know, figure it's like a Honda Civic or something like that. You know, there's a much bigger pool for that. So I had a hard time with this one. At the end of the day, I think I go with the $15,000 EV because I think the Ford F-150 will come anyway. And we're further from a $15,000 basic sedan electric vehicle than we are from a Ford F-150, I think. That's a hard one. How about you?
I think I interpreted this differently. I thought he was asking if you'd personally want the automobile, not would you rather have it out in the market?
Well, that's an interesting question. What's your answer to
that? I think your interpretation feels more right now that I think about it.
Yeah, though it's an interesting question to ask anyway. Okay, so answer personally and then answer systemically.
Oh, personally, I'd rather have the Ford F-150. I'd want to throw a mountain bike, skis, camping gear, building materials, or anything big in the back. I don't own a truck, but I'd be far less conflicted about buying a truck if it were electric. So, you know, I've had crossover SUVs in the past, and I do a lot of outdoor activities. And I grew up in New Hampshire, so I did a decent amount of like off-roading. I don't have any specific use for a truck right now, but if it were electric, I would feel more comfortable having it. And I think I could do a lot more with my lifestyle than, you know, a small $15,000 EV.
Mm-hmm. You know, the argument for the $15,000 EV is we're a single car family at the moment. We could be more likely to be a two car family if there were a $15,000 electric vehicle that we could buy and just use for our short distance trips and then keep our ICE vehicle for the long distance ones. All right. So, but now give the systemic answer. Would you rather that the world had an electric Ford F-150 or a $15,000 EV?
I'm going to have to go with the Ford F-150. I mean, I think it's America's biggest selling automobile. I forgot to look that up beforehand, but if I recall, it is one of the, if not the highest selling automobile in America. And if you can get a cost-effective automobile for that portion of the market, you've made huge inroads on electrification.
It would also be cool to see that Super Bowl commercial.
Yeah, what would that Super Bowl commercial look like?
Oh, I don't know. I wasn't thinking about that.
Do you think they'd make it green? Like, would they How would they pitch electrification for a Ford F-150 during the Super Bowl? Do they lead with green?
Yeah, I don't know how the Super Bowl commercial looks and whether it's about green, but like, you know, the one of the greatest things about electric cars is they require so much less maintenance. And I feel like if you have a truck you care and you're actually like really using it for putting a lot of wear and tear on it, like lower maintenance actually is a big deal. And lower operating costs
if you're driving
it a lot.
Yeah, and higher power, higher torque. I mean, there are so many performance things that you could play up, both long-term costs and performance, that would speak to almost everybody in the market.
Right. I mean, and that's the other big thing about electric vehicles, which I think we've talked about before, is there has not yet been like a big nationwide marketing campaign for EVs. There's, you know, bigger ones coming now through Electrify America and this new wave of models that are arriving, but Tesla does not market at all. So we just haven't seen that yet. And like if Ford put out an electric F-150, you have to assume they would do it. So I think the, you know, just like consumer education benefit of that would be huge. So actually, maybe I'm changing. Maybe you've got me convinced now that I should go back to the F-150.
Well, let's stay in transit and we'll go to Brenda Thomas's question for our last one. She is an engineering and public policy expert at Stitch Fix. And she says, would you rather have a shared autonomous fleet or more mass transit coverage in cities? And this is particularly relevant because so many cities are facing this issue right now. With the explosion of shared vehicles and the creation of Uber Pool and Lyft Line, these shared vehicles are now taking on the same function as public buses. And there's a real question about cost. You know, as more people who can afford these other transit options start using them and use public transit less, does it make public transit more expensive for people who, you know, can't afford those other options? And that's a real serious problem. So this is something that city planners and other public officials need to deal with today. So I chose this one because of that reason. So what do you think? Would you rather have shared autonomous vehicles, mass fleets of them, or would you rather have mass transit coverage in cities?
So look, I'm very excited about our shared autonomous future. I've talked about it before. I will continue to be excited about it. But this one is a super easy answer for me. I pick mass transit for a bunch of reasons. One is that, like, you know, the evidence thus far of ride sharing is that it has increased congestion in cities. There's a bunch of evidence about that. So traffic has gotten worse as a result. Second, there's a big question in the future about, as we shift to autonomy, what is that going to do to total vehicle miles traveled, which is a proxy for the environmental impact. Now, the benefit you've got is that your shared autonomous fleet is almost definitely going to be electric. It just makes more sense to have electric vehicles in one of these shared autonomous fleets because the utilization rates will be really high. So that's good. But nonetheless, there's a bunch of research out there, including a good paper that just came out pretty recently written by Peter Fox Penner, who I work with. He's the chief strategy officer at EIP and also runs the Institute for Sustainable Energy at BU, where they basically modeled out what they think the impact of the shift to autonomy will be on electricity demand relative to a world where you had electric, you know, increasingly electric vehicles, but not autonomous ones. And the takeaway was that there are factors that push in both directions. You might end up with more people who can travel longer distances to work, for example. That would increase vehicle miles traveled, but the vehicles themselves might be more efficient. They might be able to travel in fleets and stop and start less. So there are factors pushing both directions, but the net that they found in their base case was about a 20% increase in electric load from an autonomous world versus a non-autonomous world, which is all just to say that, you know, your shared autonomous fleet future has many benefits. It may also come with some significant downsides. On the other hand, mass transit is pretty much exclusively good. From my perspective, we should have more of it. It's important from an equitability perspective. It will, you know, it reduces vehicle miles traveled generally. It can also electrify quickly. So for many, many reasons, I go with mass transit. You?
Oh, yeah. We couldn't be more on the same page. Shared autonomous fleets are going to be an option, and they're going to be a really cool option. But so much careful planning needs to happen before we truly rely on AVs in our urban environments. They're going to bring a lot of convenience, but they're going to create a ton of potential problems, namely congestion, as you said, and already shared vehicles are creating congestion problems and raising vehicle miles traveled and emissions. So that's a problem that we need to sort through. They aren't necessarily clean. You can create confusion on roads when you start blending human-operated vehicles with AVs. And more importantly, I think you just deal with fairness problems. I mean, as fewer people use mass transit with autonomous fleets, public systems just will get more expensive. And the people who can't afford a shared EV subscription are going to be left paying for the system as fares increase. And so you have to use what you have. And a well-funded public transit system is the most effective way to move people around and keep pollution low. You just have to go with mass transit. I'd be really curious to know if there's anybody who wants to refute that, because I suspect most people would agree with us, but I'm sure there are some AV enthusiasts out there who've thought about that future system, and I would love to hear from you if you disagree with that.
Yeah, same. I have a hard time like picturing a very strong argument for the shared autonomous fleet over mass transit. Shared autonomous fleet in a vacuum, sure. But if you're picking between the two, more mass transit seems clear to me.
So which of these scenarios are you going to bring up at the Thanksgiving table?
That's an interesting question. I feel like the Ford F-150 versus the $15,000 electric vehicle is maybe the most accessible for my particular holiday festivity family.
I'm going to bring up Rachel Goldstein's, who's a PV analyst and a member of 350.org, and she asked us, would you rather liquidate the fossil fuel industry or watch the world burn?
Yeah, that's the one I was remembering that was like a little bit harsh. I'm going to probably try to stay away from that one as the general lesson of try to avoid politics at the Thanksgiving table. That's not one I'm going to discuss.
Well, that's going to do it for us, folks. We are going to list out each scenario in the show notes and we'll post them on Twitter. So we want to hear your answers. Hit us up on Twitter. You can find me and Shale there. And also our podcast Twitter handle is Interchange Show. You've heard it all before, but we always want to remind you that you are the front line in helping us expand our audience. So if you like this show, rate and review us on Apple Podcasts or anywhere you get your podcasts, and turn your friends and colleagues onto the podcast as well. Thanks for being with us. Happy Thanksgiving to our American listeners. We'll catch you next week. With Shale Khan, I'm Stephen Lacey. This is The Interchange, conversations on the future of energy from Green Tech Media.